The assignment for today was to look at certain verses and briefly answer the following questions. Now, these questions relate to matters we have already discussed in class. And most of you, I believe three-fourths at least, gave a very good answer to these two questions. But there was maybe a fifth of the class that did not have in mind the two matters to which this refers. So I thought I'd better say a word about it now. The first question was, do they have any bearing on the critical theory? I spoke about that last week, and I want to reiterate again. The critical theory is that the prediction in Daniel look forward to Antiochus IV, who is shown here on the brief list of the four kingdoms. He came after, he came late in the time of the third kingdom, as you notice there. I haven't shown when the third kingdom ends or the fourth begins, because as you know, the third was divided into sections and the Romans took them one at a time over a space of about 50 years. But the critical theory is that the book of Daniel was not written by Daniel, but a later writer took the name of Daniel, writing 300 years after Daniel's time, and that he wrote in the time of Antiochus IV in order to make the Jews fight valiantly against Antiochus IV by claiming to give predictions that God was going to deliver them. And so in the book, when it looks forward to Antiochus IV, he is giving history pretending it is prophecy. And when he goes on, beyond Antiochus IV, it is purely guessing on his part. Now that's the critical theory, which of course is utterly inconsistent with any belief that this is actually written by Daniel and belongs to be part of God's Word. But there are many small arguments which the critics have given, most of which have been well answered. But there is a big point that I have mentioned in class, the fact that the critics run into a serious obstacle, that it describes four kingdoms, and then after the four kingdoms, it describes the great crisis in chapter 7. There's the four kingdoms in chapter 7 and then a great crisis. And in chapter 2, there are four kingdoms and then a destruction of all that the kingdoms represent. Whereas Antiochus III comes at the end of the third kingdom. And the critics say that the author of Daniel, who gives a marvelously accurate picture of history between Nebuchadnezzar and his time, claiming it's prophecy, did make a serious mistake in this, because there were only three kingdoms. And so they say he imagined that between the Babylonian kingdom and the Persian kingdom, there was an empire you'd call the Median Empire, the Empire of the Medes. And so in relation to that, I assigned you these verses, which the first says that the most important of them in this regard is the first, where in Daniel 5:28, God said, or Daniel said to Belshazzar, your kingdom is given to the Medes and Persians. He put them together as one group. And then in chapter 6, in three cases, it speaks of the law of the Medes and Persians. And now we would not speak now about you have to obey the laws of Great Britain and the United States, if one or the other. Great Britain controlled this country till 1776, and then the United States controlled. But the law of the Medes and Persians, and chapter 8, verse 20 says, speaking of the animal that he described as making a great conquest, he says, this is the kings of Media and Persia. And in chapter 10, 1, he refers to Cyrus, king of Persia. And in chapter 11, 2, still in Daniel's lifetime, he says, there are yet three kings of Persia. So there are all these evidences that there was no kingdom of the Medes in between. The Medes were a scattered group of tribes over which there was a sort of a general authority held to which the Persians were for a time subject, but over which they gained supremacy before the end of the Babylonian Empire. Now the second question, do they prove anything about the place of the kingdoms in Daniel 8 in relation to those in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7? Now, there were one or two who thought that this word place here referred to geographical situation. I gave you an assignment some time ago in which I asked you to look at the beginning of chapter 8 and to see if you could tell which of the four kingdoms these two there related to. And that's what I mean here. The place of the kingdoms in Daniel 8 in relation to those in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. Because in Daniel 8 they're specifically named. One is the kings of Media and Persia, the other is the king of Greece. And so these are specifically named, and somebody said to me after I gave that assignment the next time, said, we learn that only from the history, don't we? And it was the end of class, and I was a little tired, I guess, and I said, yes. But I should have said, no, you learn it from these verses, which will be in the assignment 3 weeks from now. And as you notice, the verses make it clear that it was the Persians who succeeded the Babylonians and the Greeks who succeeded the Persians, and therefore chapter 8 is speaking about the two middle kingdoms and says nothing about the first, except it implies, tells about his great conquest, doesn't say what he'll conquer, but implies that, and it does not refer to the fourth kingdom at all. The assignment is this. In Daniel 9:25-26, the word Messiah occurs twice. What Hebrew word does it represent? Now, of course, those of you who've had Hebrew or had much Hebrew can easily look it up in your Hebrew Bible unless you're lazy. If you're lazy, you'll just look up Messiah in Young's Concordance. And there in Young's Concordance, if there are different words that are translated Messiah, it will give these words with an English transliteration and the Hebrew word and give you the references. And you can easily see there what Hebrew word is used for Messiah in these two places. Then, if you have a Hebrew concordance or have access to one, you can look up this Hebrew word and see all the cases where it's used. If you want, however, you can look in this Hebrew word up in the back of Young's Concordance. You can do that even, they're arranged in English type of letters, so it's easy to look up even if you know no Hebrew. And look it up and see how many different ways it is translated, this word in the Old Testament. Like, for instance, if the word says is translated Messiah twice, and if it is translated God five times, those are two ways this word is translated. And in such a case, you would have to decide from the context which of the two was right, or whether in some way they represent two different phases of the same idea. So the assignment continues, how many times is this word used in the Old Testament? Be sure to include any instances where it has a pronominal suffix such as his or my. In how many ways does the King James Version render the word into English? List the verses where it occurs. You can easily get them out of the Hebrew Concordance or out of Young's Concordance. You can also get them out of Strong's if you want, but it takes a little bit longer. List the verses where it occurs. After each reference, state whether it refers to a prophet, a priest, a king, or something else. You should be able to tell that at a glance in each case, I believe. And count the references in each category. Now, of course, if there's some you're not sure which, just put them with a question mark. And then, further question, is the term ever applied to a non-Israelite? If so, where? This takes almost longer to give than it will to do, but you will find it on the bulletin board. Now we are speaking about chapter 11. And chapter 11 has much in it that is rather difficult to understand precisely what it means. And there are two reasons for this. The reasons for this are because the prophecy relating to future events is not given with real explicitness. You take the prophecies of Christ in the New Testament, and he says, this was done that it might be fulfilled. But in most cases, you can see how it has been fulfilled, but you wouldn't in advance be able to predict exactly how it will be fulfilled. And so these predictions, while none of them are figurative, they are practically all in plain language, yet the language is a bit vague in these predictions of the future. It is not given to satisfy curiosity about the future. It is given in order that people can see that he really spoke from God and see how these things were fulfilled. And so we notice how the statements about Seleucus Nicator were fulfilled in verse 5. Seleucus the Conqueror, literally, he was called that in his lifetime, and later on they called him Seleucus I. But we read in verse 5 how he was a prince of Ptolemy, the king of the south, but he became stronger than Ptolemy and had a great dominion. So we have that about Seleucus predicted 200 years in advance. You couldn't tell what was going to happen, but when you see it happen, you know that if the words had been stated differently, it would not have been fulfilled. Then we notice number 2, Antiochus II and Bernice. And that was a very striking event, an event which was everyone in Syria and in Egypt was aware of what happened. I don't think you could have told later exactly what was going to happen. You notice verse 6 says, in the end of years they will join themselves together. In other words, there's a space of time in between here, and it skips over Antiochus I completely and goes to Antiochus II. And Antiochus II and Ptolemy II, your sheet shows you, were reigning at the same time. And when Antiochus II was reigning, Ptolemy II was becoming an old man, because you notice that he began to reign in 283, and Antiochus II only in 261. And there had been considerable strife between the two kingdoms, and now they tried to make a treaty of alliance, and in those days they usually sealed such treaties by having an intermarriage. And so, as we mentioned last time, Seleucus, who was already married to Laodice, who had grown sons, now discarded her and married Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II. And as the verse says here, the king's daughter of the south shall king come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm. And you remember he lived with her a brief time and then he left her and went up into Asia Minor where his first wife was living. And his first wife was afraid he would make the children of Bernice his successors, the infant child of Bernice, and so it's usually thought she poisoned him. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her, and he that strengthened her in these times. And after he died, the people who favored his son to succeed him managed to get a hold of Bernice and of her child and kill them. Now this phrase, he that begot her, is usually taken to mean that her father died at just about this time. Though I noticed the New International Version changes it to, and her son, and bases that on the ancient translations into Syriac and Latin, which render it that way. He that begot her, render it rather as the one that was begotten by her, her son, who was killed along with her. Whichever way you take it, You see, it fits with what happened. And then, in number 3, we go down to Egypt, Ptolemy 3rd, and verses 7 to 9 say, out of a branch of her root shall one stand up in his estate. Now, in his estate suggests that it refers to her father's death, he that begot her. He shall stand up in his place, a branch of her roots, in other words, her brother, and he made a great attack, as we read in chapter 7, verses 7 to 9, in which his armies went through a great part of the Seleucid Empire, and he took a great amount of booty, and he carried it south with him, and he continued more years than the king of the north. But he outlived Seleucus II and even Seleucus III. But the second son of Seleucus II is Antiochus III. And as I mentioned last time, Antiochus III was one of the great conquerors of antiquity. And 11 verses are devoted to the history of Antiochus III. As far as we are concerned, the interest of these is that though it would be pretty hard to tell in advance what it predicted, it is historic from the history easy to see that it touches upon most of the great events of Antiochus III's reign and touches upon them in the order in which they occurred. We will not take much time for that now. By the way, I have been asked about if someone would like to look further into this particular matter. On this material, up to Antiochus IV, there is no difference of opinion. Conservatives believe that it is a remarkably accurate prediction that Daniel made of events up to the time of Antiochus IV. And liberals believe that it is a remarkably accurate picture of what occurred, written by somebody who already knew what had occurred. And if you're interested in details on it, beyond what we have time to go into in class, almost any extensive commentary on Daniel will give them to you. Whether it be a liberal commentary or a conservative commentary, there will be no difference on this particular section. Any good commentary will do that. Now, there are a number of books on the history of the Seleucids. The most extensive I know of is one by Bevan called The House of the Seleucids, which I have used a considerable amount, an English scholar who gave a great deal of attention to the ancient sources that tell about this period. But we better not take much time on the history of Antiochus III in these 11 verses. I must point out 2 or 3 matters about it. I believe I mentioned last time that Palestine and Syria, Palestine and southern Syria, had belonged to Egypt for 150 years. And Antiochus III, in addition to his spending 15 years conducting expeditions to the east and reestablishing the control that Seleucus I had made over the area Alexander had conquered right to the borders of India, that in addition to that, he fought with Ptolemy of Egypt, and he took away from him Syria and Palestine and southern Syria. He took them and annexed them to his territory. And we read in verse 14, in those days there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fail. And that is usually taken to mean that there were Jews in Palestine who, not satisfied with the generally decent way they had been treated by the Ptolemies for 150 years, thought they would be much better off under the Seleucids. And therefore, to establish their vision of freedom from the Ptolemies, they gave their help to Antiochus III in getting them away from Ptolemy into the hands of the Syrians.
But they shall fail means, of course, that their vision, their idea, how much better off we'll be under the Seleucids, proved to be utterly false because they were far worse off. At least they were when Antiochus IV became king. And so that was verse 14, and we have the in the end of verse 17 that says, "He shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on her side, neither before him." Antiochus III thought he would emulate Alexander the Great's conquest. He had reestablished the Seleucid Empire over the whole East, but he didn't have the territory that Alexander had come from, Macedonia, this section of Europe, which belonged to him. And so he wanted to make his situation safe over here, and so he made a peace arrangement with Ptolemy V, and he gave Ptolemy V his daughter Cleopatra in marriage to seal the bond, thinking she, as queen of Egypt, would give her support to him. But she didn't. It says, "But she shall not stand on his side, neither before him," because that was a great disappointment to him when she threw her whole loyalty to her husband and to the Egyptians, and she was the first Egyptian queen to bear the name of Cleopatra. And then verse 18 says, "After this he shall turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many." And we know that Antiochus III turned westward, north and westward. He already held most of Asia Minor, which the Seleucids had held for a century and a half. He now marched across the Hellespont into Europe and began seizing territory in Europe. And he was quite successful in seizing Macedonia, the territory to the north, and much of Greece. And then he got a message from Rome, and a Roman representative said to him, he said, "We want you to stop trying to make conquests in Europe." And he said, "I don't interfere in Italy, in your region. What right do you have to interfere with what I do back here?" And so the Romans, whether they had any right might be questioned, but they had the might. And they sent an army which defeated him in Thermopylae, drove him back out of Europe, and then followed him into Asia Minor, and there defeated him at Magnesia. So verse 18 says, "After this he shall turn his face unto the isles and shall take many, but a prince on his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found." A very brief summary of what happened when the Romans, after driving him out from Greece, after their great victory at Thermopylae, followed him into Asia Minor. And there in Asia Minor they fought a great battle at Magnesia, and as a result of this battle they completely defeated him. And when he was thus completely defeated, the Romans made him pay them the whole cost of their expedition, give reparations for all that it had cost them to send the expedition, promised to pay a large sum of money each year for the next 12 years, and give them 20 of his leading supporters, including some of his own sons, to go to Rome and live there as hostages for his good behavior. And so this complete and utter defeat to Antiochus III completely ruined the great glory that he had gotten in 35 years of hard fighting. And it is summarized here, "He'll turn his face to the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found." And this word "stumble" is interesting. It doesn't suggest he's killed in war. It doesn't suggest that he dies in his bed. It doesn't suggest there's an uprising. What happened was that in trying to pay these heavy reparations to the Romans, he went eastward in order to loot the temples of various deities. And he came into a little temple of a small tribe west that he looked on with utter contempt, but he knew they had considerable treasure in their temple. He had taken treasure from temples of various deities. He went into this one, and he was getting careless, and the local guardians simply got excited and killed him. And so he stumbled and fell. He was killed in such a minor little thing, a man who had carried on these tremendous successful warlike expeditions. And so that is what is said about Antiochus III in 11 verses. And then I have listed Seleucus 4th verse 20, because it is very interesting that we have only one verse, but the verse shows a remarkable contrast to Antiochus III. So Seleucus IV, his oldest son, succeeded him, and the kingdom was in pretty bad shape because they had to pay these heavy reparations to the Romans, and they had so many of their leaders in Rome as hostages. And so there shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the king. The glory of his great warlike expeditions was gone. All he could do was to try to get money together to pay and to the indemnities and to get in good shape again. And so Seleucus the fourth reigned for 11 years. But he got no glory, but he did get the government on a good fiscal basis again by raising taxes and getting things organized in the kingdom. But then we read within a few days, and compared to Antiochus III's reign from 223 to 187, 11 years seems like a few days. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Now, how are you destroyed? Neither in anger nor in battle. His chief minister made a plot against him and murdered him. And so he was destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. And his chief minister, who destroyed him that way, tried then to reign in the name of his infant son. He had an older son who was a hostage in Rome. But in the name of the infant son, the chief minister tried to reign. But he didn't succeed very long. And the next ruler is so important from a biblical viewpoint that I'm giving him another main head, a capital D, Antiochus Epiphanes. And Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV, called himself Epiphanes. And he is given 15 verses here, and in the history of Judaism, he is one of the most important rulers. Why is he important to Israel? Because he was not simply a man who wanted conquest, though he did. He's not simply a man who caused trouble for the Jews and made persecution, which he did. But he, toward the latter part of his reign, set himself on a definite policy of completely destroying the Jewish religion and forcing the Jews to become pagan. And when he tried first to be nice to them and give all kinds of favors to the ones who would turn pagan, and many did, but some stood very strongly against him, he proceeded to extremely harsh measures, and the religion of the Old Testament, humanly speaking, would have been completely wiped off, except that a priest who resisted his efforts to force the people to sacrifice in every little town, and they came to the town where this man worked, he and his sons fled into the wilderness, and they became such good guerrilla fighters, they came to be called the Hammers, or the Maccabees. And to them others joined, and eventually they gained their freedom complete from him. Now number two is his career. And in order to understand something of this crisis that occurred at this time, it is necessary to know something about this man, Antiochus IV. Antiochus IV, as you know from your chart here, was the second son of Antiochus III. The oldest son was Seleucus, who succeeded Antiochus. When Antiochus IV was a hostage in Rome, and we don't know how many years he lived there, but he lived there long enough to become very familiar with Roman customs and situations and methods of doing things. And then he was released from his being a hostage in Rome, and Seleucus III's oldest son, who became Demetrius down at the very bottom of your sheet, he was made a hostage in Rome, and Antiochus was released. And Antiochus then went to Greece and lived there. And he lived in Athens and became an important official in the Athenian government. I've even heard it called a mayor. I don't know exactly what the title was or what the position. But he was very successful there. He had no right to become king because Demetrius, his older brothers, had a son who was a hostage in Rome and should succeed him properly. But when Seleucus, his older brother, was killed, Antiochus immediately got in touch with some people in Asia Minor who had funds, had considerable funds, and got them to fund him to try to become king. And he came with a small force into Asia Minor, and he managed to get support with all kinds of promises, and he became king after his brother's death, and killed Heliodorus, and also killed the infant son in whose name Heliodorus was reigned. And so verse 21 says, "In his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." And so he thus secured control there, and he reigned from 176 to 164. And he was a man with very peculiar characteristics. He called himself Epiphanes. Now, Epiphanes means there is a feast in the in many certain denominations now called the Feast of the Epiphany. That's the feast of the appearance of the Lord. And so when he called himself Epiphanes, he was claiming to be a God on earth. He is the outshining God. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. But he began, when he first came to Antioch, going around among the people soliciting votes, acting as if it was a democratic organization like Rome and Athens, and looking for votes, which he had gotten in Athens. And he went from one extreme to the other in his reign. He would be a tyrant who would kill people on the slightest provocation, and then he would turn around and do just all kinds of things for people and act in a way as if he was just one of the commonest of people. And he was very unpredictable. But one thing he wanted was he wanted a unity in his kingdom. And he wanted everyone to worship him as a god and to worship the gods he worshiped. His brother had gathered considerable funds by this time. He set out to build a new temple to Zeus in Athens. And he built a tremendous temple, one of the greatest temples in Athens. He was unable to complete it in his life, and it remained that way for 200 years, and then a Roman emperor completed this great temple, one of the largest temples in Athens. After a time, he saw his sister, you know, was the queen in Egypt. And when her husband died and there were two small two young boys, the oldest of whom was nominally the king, though his ministers were actually ruling. Antiochus decided that he would try to take over control of Egypt. And so he led an army down into Egypt. And there in Egypt, he made up with his nephew, who was nominally the king, but who was in his teens still. And the two of them ate together, and he told that he thought he would rule Egypt through his nephew being the nominal king. And so he talked to him as if he was going to do everything for him, while the nephew was actually planning to throw off his control just as soon as he could. And so we read here how they told lies at one table. And they sat there eating together, telling lies to one another. The city of Alexandria, one of the great centers of Egypt, he was unable to get control of. And he thought he had established his nephew and that his nephew would get control of Alexandria. And he went back to his own land, and on the way he stopped in Jerusalem in order to rob the temple. And this brought him in sharp contact with the Jews, of course, and gave him an idea of how opposed they were to his desire to make them all pagan. Then he got to Antioch, and he held a tremendous celebration at which he invited people from all over the known world and spent tremendous sums on this tremendous celebration, in which he himself put on a great dance, and he himself did all kinds of things, mixing with the crowd in many different ways. And then he found that his nephew in Egypt had thrown off all relationship with him, declared himself entirely independent, and so he marched to Egypt again with a large force, and he came down to Egypt and got practically all of Egypt under his control. And when he had it practically all under his control, except the one city of Alexandria, which he was expecting soon to get control of, a ship arrived from Rome. And the ship arrived, and he heard there were important Roman officials on the ship, and he went down to the ship, to the shore, in order to greet them. And the one of them, a man named Popilius Linus, had been a good friend of his when he was in Rome. And he greeted him, and he says, "Hello, Popilius, so nice to see you." And Popilius didn't smile or anything. He sternly said, "I have a message for you from the Roman Senate." And he says, "Oh, that's fine." He says, "Well," he says, let's have a good chat, and we'll have a dinner together, and then I'll read the message." He says, "The message must be read right now." "Well," he says, "what is the message then?" So he took out the message. "The Roman Senate declares that you must immediately leave Egypt and return to Asia and give up all attempts to conquer any of Egypt." And he says, that will require a bit of consideration. And Papilius took his staff, and he made a mark on the sand, a circle around where Antiochus was standing. He says, "You can consider it just as long as you stay inside of that circle." And when he said that, well, he was pretty well familiar with the rising power of Rome, having lived in Rome some years. And, "Oh," he says, all right, of course I will," he says then, "if it's that important, that serious." "And come on," he says, "let's have dinner." And so they went and had a dinner together and were good fellows. And the other fellow who'd been so stern now became friendly and cordial. But he wasn't as happy as he made out to be. So he went back up to his own land, and he was very upset after that. And the Romans, for years after that, loved to tell about that incident, showing how their power was recognized even as far away as Egypt by his abject surrender at this occasion. But when he got back, now he determined that he was going to put an end to the attitude of these Jews. And so now he began harshly persecuting them, trying to seize the copies of the scriptures, sending agents to all the little villages, forcing people to sacrifice to Jupiter, going into into the temple in Jerusalem, and taking away taking in the temple, putting up by the altar there a statue of Zeus, of the Greek god, and forcing the people to sacrifice to him and to sacrifice swine's flesh on the altar. And the persecution was so intense then. If you ever get a chance to read Longfellow's dramatic poem, The Maccabees, it gives a very good picture of the events that occurred then, a very beautiful picture. We used it once at one of our occasions at the beginning of the school year a few years ago and went through the main parts of it. It's a very fine picture of the general course of events at this time. But after this persecution was well underway, Antiochus found he was beginning to run out of money. And so he went east in order to try to recoup his fortunes from some of the centers where there was a good deal of money available. And there he was taken with a nervous illness and shortly died. But his young son became king for a brief time after him. The persecution was continued. The group of the Maccabees fought, and they eventually gained their independence and made a treaty of mutual support with Rome, and they were completely independent for a half a century or more before the Romans finally took over what remained of the Seleucid Empire. And so Antiochus IV is a very vivid character, a very dramatic character, and to him, the attack on Judaism was a comparatively small part of his activity, but it was something that would have meant a complete end to the Old Testament and to the teachings given in it, had it not been for the Maccabean uprising. And when the Maccabees, however, began to gain power, then other people began to join with them who were not so interested in the real causes at issue, and eventually the descendants of the Maccabees ruled independently, but fell very far short of the standards with which they began. And so they are not remembered with great favor among the Jews. But it was the greatest crisis, perhaps, in the history of the religion of Israel prior to the time of Christ. And so Antiochus IV is so important in this regard that it is important to see how in Daniel 11, 21 to 35, we have events of it described. And if you read through these verses, you will see how many of the things I mentioned are suggested there. Now, the assignment is posted, as you know, and we continue there next time.